Tanzania has been to war before.
Who was helping Tanzania?
Nobody, but we had to borrow
weapons.
Call it formerly the Soviet Union or China.
Okay.
I can tell you they are not the Western countries because they did. Because of the commitment of our government to help the liberation of South Africa, we were exposing ourselves to a lot of dangers. I've been Minister of Industry for nearly 10 years.
Sabrina on Cast.
Hello, and welcome to the episode 8 of the Sabrina on Cast podcast. I'm absolutely honored and delighted to be joined by former Prime Minister and Vice President of the United Republic of Tanzania, Honorable Cleopa David Msuya. After graduating from Makerere University, he went into public service in the Department of Community Development and then served as Permanent Secretary in several ministries. He became Minister for Finance on February 18, 1972, and served in that position until he became Minister for Industry in 1975. 5 years later, he was appointed Prime Minister for the first time in November 1980, serving until February 1983. He was then Minister for Finance again, his portfolio was expanded, and he became Minister for Finance, Economic Affairs and Planning, and later on Minister for Industry and Trade. He held the record for a very long time as the only Tanzanian who was lucky enough to be nominated for the Prime Minister's Heart by two different presidents, Mwalimu Julius Kambarage Nyerere and President Ali Hassan Mwinyi. In December 1994, Msuya became Prime Minister for a second time, concurrently serving as Vice President. He's the first Prime Minister in Tanzania to be endorsed by the Parliament and to hold two senior positions, Prime Minister and Vice President, at the same time. He relinquished his position in the historic new multi-party elections, held for the first time in 1995, and was later appointed to a special constitutional assembly, a position he held until his retirement in 2000. Cleopa David Msuya is one of the few living legends of Tanzania. He's the true definition of an uncommon statesman, honorable, pragmatic, patriot, and ardent public servant. He achieved almost impossible during the worst economic crisis of our country. And since then, he is renowned as the father of structural economic reforms of Tanzania. I'm truly honored and very excited to welcome you on Sabrina on Cast podcast, Mheshimiwa. After graduating from Makerere University College in 1955, you went into government service in the Department of Community Development in 1956, serving as an officer in the field and later on rising to head of your department as Commissioner for Community Development in 1962. When was it along your career when you got interested in politics and why? Was it a childhood ambition or did it just came later on?
I think I'll try and be as brief and as frank as I can. If I look back at my history, from the time I was born, I went to a primary school in my little village of Sangi. I went to Old Moshi Secondary School for the Standard 10 examinations.
Okay.
That was 1944 to 1949.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there I went to Tabora High School.
Okay.
For Cambridge School Certificate.
Mm-hmm.
At that time I was raw in politics and we cared about studies and the passing examination, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Fortunately after Tabora I was selected to go to Makerere. And it is Makerere University College where I studied from 1952, I think it was, to 55, where we were influenced enormously by the politics that were happening around us.
Mm-hmm.
First, in Kampala alone, we Tanganyikans who were there, we saw that there was a lot of quarrel between the government of Uganda and the Kabaka of Uganda. Kabaka is the one who rules the Bagandas.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a prime minister called Katikiro. So there was a lot of skirmishes and wars. And even students from Uganda whom were studying, mm-hmm. they were all divided because some of them were pro the governor, mm-hmm. some of them pro the Kabaka,
yeah.
some of them pro the Katikiro, who was the prime minister of Kabaka. So we began learning, what is all this? But we also met our friends from Kenya. At that time, Mau Mau was flaring up in Kenya. Some of the Kikuyu friends were with Mai and others who were together. The story they told you of Kenya and how the colonial government, the army KR, were fighting the Kikuyus and the system oath taking to make them fight the whites and kill them and what have you. So there was a lot of trouble. And they could really sense that the Kikuyus and the Africans in Kenya had no power. The power was with the settlers and the colonial authorities. We had some students from Central Africa, Malawi, Zambia, what is now Zambia, at that time it was Northern Rhodesia, and Southern Rhodesia. They were studying in Makerere.
Okay.
And the story is the same. Discrimination. And these who came over to Makerere, they said the only way they could learn university education because the money there was mostly being used to educate the whites and whatever. And for example, a country like Northern Rhodesia, which produced most of the wealth from the copper, and the one which actually developed in Southern Rhodesia, which was the seat of the settlers in Rhodesia. And then, of course, we read about Boers and apartheid in South Africa.
Yeah.
And at that time, until the beginning of TANU, which Nyerere had formed using some senior Tanganyika Africans, and had formed this CCM. And at that time, I think one of the period there, he went to UN to present what I might call the African viewpoint. It's that which really inspired some of us to think about our future. And I remember in that kind of struggle, we Tanganyikan students in Makerere formed what we call the Tanganyika Discussion Group. And I was the chairman to talk about our own future in Tanganyika when we go back. How do we fare? How do we treat the whites? How do we transfer power from the colonial authorities to, you know, whatever, that kind of thing. So if it's a question of influence, my politics,
that's
there,
where you got your influence.
Yeah. Makerere.
Okay.
Because all these things that were happening around us.
Okay.
Beside your topmost government position and responsibility as the leader of Tanzania government business in the National Assembly, through your position as Prime Minister, you have had long tenures of key dockets of finance and economics. First as Principal Secretary at the Ministry for Economic Affairs and Planning, that was in 1967 to 1970. And Ministry of Finance in 1970 to 1972. And then as Minister of Finance in 1972 to 1975. And then again Minister of Finance in 1983 to 1985. Which was then expanded to Minister for Finance, Economic Affairs and Planning in 1985 to 1989. How and why was it that you specifically kept in that area of portfolios? Are you an economist or finance specialist by background?
The short answer is not. I'm not an economist, nor am I a financial expert.
What did you study in Makerere?
My studies in Makerere were three subjects. History, political science, and geography.
Huh?
And in political science, we studied a lot about political theories, how societies are ruled and administered from Plato in the olden days of the Greek history.
Okay.
To changes that were taking place in the Europe Revolution, of the French Revolution, how the British monarchy was gradually whittled of power, and eventually Parliament emerged, you know, those kind of things. So we were introduced to the thinking which goes in forming a system to administer a society. There are different systems. Communist is a different one. Marxists came with the theory, what they wanted to do with the Russians, what have you. And then you go to the Chinese, they have a different system. Chinese, yes, communist, yes, but slightly different from the Russian one, with a lot of coloring of their own cultural system. So when I came out and went to the community development, eventually I came to be the head of the department. I was moved around several ministries. First ministry was community development, national culture. After some time, I was moved over to the Ministry of Lands and Settlement, which dealt with the villages, and that time was the talking point of Tano government, that once they become independent, we're going to promote villagization as a central core of our rural development policy. And then after that, I was pushed over to be the permanent secretary in the Ministry of Economic Affairs and Development Planning. And in that area that I was given the responsibility of formulating the post-Arusha Declaration 5-year development plan. The Arusha Declaration was earlier, but then to have a plan which incorporates the ideas of Arusha Declaration was given to this 5-year plan which we had drawn. And I was given a large number of expatriates there, Russians, Indians, Americans, whatever. And sometimes they would not agree. So I was posted there to see whether I can push them together and see whether we can come out with a plan which answers the basic tenets of Arusha Declaration. And I think I succeeded in doing that. Now, why did they keep on moving me between these ministries? My own assumption is that first, we were not very many who was around. But secondly, perhaps more than anything else, I was the most exposed senior person who had seen colonial administration in the field, who had seen initial thinking in the post-independent government in the ministry like national culture, community development, national culture, village settlement and lands, and then economic affairs and planning this. And I think the authority that be must have thought that because I was involved in the formulation of the second 5-year plan, maybe the best thing is to keep me in that area. And I think they benefited from my experience, and I also benefited from the trust that the authorities really imposed on me. So my justification is not so much whether I was an economist or a financial specialist. It's the exposure to the thinking and the underlying principles which were trying to be formulated in making Tanzania a society slightly different from others. Not necessarily all economic, not necessarily all finance, but those that involve the broader aspects of society and development. I think that is the reason which prompted the authority to keep me moving around those ministries. But your guess is as good as mine. I didn't vote for it. They appointed me and pushed me into those areas. Those of us who were few and who were brought into the government at that time, in the middle of the independence, the Tanzanians, the Tanganyikans, we had all agreed that we are going to replace the European civil servants, we are going to replace the Asian civil servants. But we have to prove that we can work long hours, we can come up with basic ideas on having understood what the object of our government is, and really show to them that we trust, we accept their trust on us.
And delivered.
And something which I don't find very much in these days. People don't work very hard. They don't. I remember I used to work until about 10 o'clock in the night in Gazina.
Wow.
And Nyerere once commented in National Executive that whenever I move from State House, I see the light burning, which is unusual.
Oh, yeah.
The others, once you reach 2 o'clock or 3 o'clock or 4 o'clock, people gone. But most of us committed and were used to exchange views. How are you getting on in your sector? How are you getting on? And we wanted to prove that nobody will ever point a finger to us and say, you have failed us. If we failed, bad luck. Luckily, you must do it. I don't know whether that kind of spirit, you are finding it widespread in our system right now.
No, you can't find that. Without extra hours.
So you have to encourage that kind of thing. Because until it comes up, we are not going to move. And I told you we were very few of us. We were hardly 12 or 13 graduates.
Do you remember anyone in particular?
Of course. Some of them are dead. The head of the civil service was Mr. Nkembo. We came out together. We went to the head of civil service and then eventually posted to UNICEF. He died. I had a colleague, Jeremiah Boyogaba, from Bukoba. Went, I don't know whether he's still there in Bukoba or somewhere. But most
Amir Jamal?
Amir Jamal was my minister.
Okay.
When I was a permanent secretary in the Treasury, Jamal was my minister.
Okay.
And I don't want to go to details. When Nyerere called me and said, I want to make you a member of parliament and at the same time I want to appoint you minister of finance. My first reaction was, but I'm permanent secretary, I'm working very well with my minister, Jamal. What is the problem?
He
said, no, I want him to be there. I want him to help me in another. So he kept on arguing. After a lot of argument, I said, well, I'm ready to try this job.
Okay.
If you think so. But I want to know that I'm happy with my minister. We work very closely. So this when I joined Jamal's he was our third Minister of Finance. The first one was Sir Ernest Vez, who was a Kenyan European.
Okay.
And then Paul Bowman for a brief period.
Okay.
And then Jamal for quite a bit of time. And then after him, me.
Having seen and been part of the evolution of Tanganyika and then Tanzania from its infancy to date, a much more matured nation, at what point along your finance and economics career timeline, mostly at the helm of those dockets, did you experience the most challenging of times in our nation's history?
The most challenging period is when the economy is deteriorating, petrol prices going up, prices were commodities in the international market collapsing, Idi Amin war, the breakdown of the East African community. And mind you, at that time, because of the commitment of our government to help liberation of South Africa, we were hosting the Liberation Committee of the OAU here in Dar es Salaam. And that means that the president was also the chairman of that committee. And we were exposing ourselves to a lot of dangers from Mozambique with the Portuguese and South Africa and the Southern Rhodesia, the security agents and whatever. We were also thrown into expenses of having to construct the Tazara Railway to help make sure that Zambia is not stifled, the economy is not stifled, because the Rhodesians are going to block their outlet to sea through the railways. So we had to organize. Nyerere and Kaunda, they went to China. After asking everybody, they couldn't get the money, the China built the rail. And at that time we were spending so much money on this route. We called it the whole route. There was the railway, there was a pipeline, Tazam pipeline, which pumped the finished products from here to Zambia. There was the road. They used a formula to call it the hell run. When the oil was being transported by the road from here to Zambia. Three big projects. And Mwalimu was very good in explaining to the people, gentlemen, kupanga ni kuchagua. We were chosen to help Zambia and South Africa, countries which are still under dominance. And we are going to use a lot of money in these three infrastructure development projects, plus the security element, which we don't even know when they're going to attack us. They did actually try it. They sent some aeroplanes to Nachingwe and Mtwara, and at one time they even came to Slender Bridge and dropped some things. So we are really exposed to a lot of these dangers because of what we were trying to help the freedom fighters. So if you really want to ask me, it's not a once period, it's something which is spread over a period. And really won the country down. And you may know that Nyerere, I think it was 1980, he indicated that he wanted to step down. And hand over to someone else. But the people would not accept it. They said, oh no, you go on and handle your chumini, it's not good. I think it will be better. So he agreed to stay for another 5 years. And when the 5 years were over, the situation was also getting worse. So eventually I said, I think the best thing is let me get out. Let's get a new leadership. I will help from outside. The point I'm trying to say, this business of most frustrating is not for me, it is for the country. That thing started from the late 70s to about 1885, 86, when we entered into some kind of arrangement with the international community and World Bank and whatever and whatever. Then the economy began going up a little bit.
Okay, from your perspective, what financial and economic impacts and challenges did the war have on Tanzania, and how is the aftermath?
We had to finance the war effort ourselves, some of which people contributed voluntarily, like cattle, money, transport, for example, people with lorries and whatever. But armaments we had to borrow from friendly countries to be paid later. And we have been continuously paying.
The story of reparation?
Pardon?
They didn't compensate you.
We did not claim any war reparations from the Ugandans. Except those expenses which were incurred in installing their new government after Amini. Because they came from Tanzania, they needed a lot of backup. Sometimes their salary will not be paid, the revenue collection has not yet been established or whatever. So there are certain amounts of money which were sent there in cash or in kind, which we had agreed that it should be repaid back. At least when I was there, they were still paying. I don't know whether they finished or something has happened. I don't know.
Yeah, I want you to tell me the story of Palestine and Libya involvement in the Kagera War.
I can't. The only way I can explain it is that I think there was some kind of Muslim sympathy between Amini and Gaddafi and the Palestinians. The Palestinians know that we have been very strong supporters of them because of this Israeli business. But why their people should go to Amin? But we said it's not notwithstanding that. We are determined. They brought in aeroplanes, they brought in, I think, a few fighters. And this war was not an armored war in that sense. It was people's war. So our men I walked, I literally walked through Kagera, Uganda, Kampala, till they pushed Germany out.
So who was helping Tanzania?
Huh?
Who was helping Tanzania?
Nobody helping in that sense of we were with, but we had to borrow
weapons.
Mm-hmm.
From
countries that would agree.
What are the examples of the countries?
I can tell you they are not the Western countries because they didn't know.
So from African countries?
No African countries. Which African country can tell you? Nani? Who? So the people who were the armaments were either what they would call formerly the Soviet Union or China.
Or China, okay.
Yeah. Because we had to borrow some of those.
So, of course, Tanzania eventually won the war.
Yeah.
But in 1980, Sokoine offered his resignation to Nyerere and left the premiership. Is it because of the economic crisis?
My understanding is that he went for further studies, but this business of resigning and what have you, I don't know. My understanding was he went for further studies.
Where?
Yugoslavia.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at some of the things that have been written by, who are these people? Remamo or something?
Remamo, yeah, somewhere.
He studied economics of socialist economy, whatever that is.
Mm-hmm.
So he went and he came back. And then his major item, which he undertook, was this fight against sabotage of the economy.
Okay.
I had advised the right president, I had advised even Sokoine that one. The problem, if there is somebody hiding anything, it must be very minimal. I have been Minister of Industry for nearly 10 years, and I know that there wasn't much because the country was not important. I have been moving around in some of the go-downs or whatever. You will always find some of the old gadgetry lying in there, go-downs. But to say that, for example, there's plenty of sugar hidden or whatever, I think this is a fallacy. So, but he went on, he advised the authorities, they launched this war against sabotage or whatever. But after some time, I think Nyerere realized that it was a mistake. And he issued a directive that those people were harmed and their property were ruined, they should be repaid by government. So gradually we paid some of them who were identified, knowing that the problem is the accumulation of what I've told you. The economy had been going down, and that the treatment of that needed a broader aspect. And this is what you call a structural adjustment.
Mm-hmm. So, did Mwalimu accept the resignation?
The what?
Mwalimu, did he accept the resignation?
I don't know. You can go on talking about the resignation. I'm telling you, my understanding, he went for further studies.
Okay.
And he must have gone and arranged for it.
Mm-hmm. What was the arrangement?
To study.
Only to study. And then what?
You're dancing.
You are renowned as the father of structural economic reforms of Tanzania. Please tell us what structural reforms were and how you managed to accomplish them.
Now, after this deterioration of the economy, and this was studied even before Nyerere stepped down, it was agreed by the government that we have to look at the broader aspects of what was happening and see whether we could come out with a program that will gradually lift us from this situation that we find ourselves in. And then we needed to look at every sector. For example, we had a system of price controls. Sugar, meat, everything was controlled. So the best thing, one of the structural adjustment thing was remove the price control mechanism.
Regulation.
And let the system float.
Yeah.
because of the shortage, black market prices were generally accepted as being fair. For example, the dollar, although we said the official rate was 125 or something, people were buying dollars at more shillings per dollar than the official. So relaxation of press control was one measure in that particular sense. We liberalized the marketing system. Formerly, farmers and whatever had to sell their items through cooperatives and from cooperatives through marketing boards and then eventually exports. The system was liberalized that if people felt they would make more money by selling directly, let them sell. You don't have to go through the cooperatives or through the marketing board. To allow people to take advantage of what you might call the free market. And that will release more people to produce. Another relaxation, structural adjustment measure we put in was to allow people to import any item they wanted to import if they use their own foreign exchange with no questions answered. So if you had your own foreign exchange, you wanted to import certain items which you thought you could make more money, bring them in, sell, the people will be happy and you'll be happy. So there were a lot of these structural adjustment things. And on the domination of the parastatal sector, it was agreed that we should encourage participation by private sector by joint ventures, or they can invest on their own. So there were a lot of structural, sectoral measures taken. The total impact of which was to loosen the system and encourage people to use the initiative to make more money, which was then allowed under the system. One other area which was liberalized was, for example, transport in Dar es Salaam. Formerly we used to have DMT, Dar es Salaam Motor Transport System. And since then it was allowed that anybody with a vehicle of his own, they could run them with Dala Dala and they'll be allowed to run the transport in the city. So they've lasted even today. Dala Dala is still running in town. Parallel to the public transport system of these faster
Mwendokasi.
You became Prime Minister from November 1980 to February 1983, and 11 years later again, from December 1994 to November 1995. In the interim, you served in several ministries, including Minister of Finance and Economics, and then Minister for Industry and Trade. Then you were appointed back to Prime Minister. We all know being a Prime Minister is the highest rank in the government. How did this come about?
If you understand the principle behind it, as I explained to you, it's very simple. In this particular case, the second was purely a matter for Zanzibar. For first vice president, which is your question, it's because of this principle that at any one time, you should not allow the position of president and vice president to come from one part of the union. So because Mwinyi was the president, somebody under Mwinyi, who comes from the island, should then be first vice president in matters of union. In addition to being prime minister, which is, means running the affairs of the United Republic, it will want to serikali ya bara. And that makes sense? Two things. There are matters which are purely union matters. The normal procedure would be they would come to me, ministries in mainland, I'll report to the president. If they must go to the cabinet, the president of Zanzibar will have a say on what needs to be done. If they are purely matters which concern the mainland, I'll clear to my president and then we can go and implement them.
Okay, you're the first prime minister to be endorsed by the parliament in the current format. What was the reason for the change to the current system as opposed to previous format of the president appointing prime minister?
The political liberalization that was taking place in the multi-party system did indicate that they were no longer possible to assume that these two top chiefs are going to come from the same party. And the development of politics in Zanzibar, particularly Pemba and Unguja, were very clear when the opposition party took over virtually the whole of Pemba and the other party. So it was a matter of time, and the difference was very minor, and the population is about the same. So the political designers thought what is important is not so much the issue of whether somebody, the president of Zanzibar, should be the vice president. The issue should be to entrench this principle that under no circumstances should the two posts be held by people from the same
party.
Or parts of you know. And that what is important is that a vice president for the United Republic represents Zanzibar, and one of his portfolio is union matters, will safeguard interests of Zanzibar, in addition to the president of Zanzibar being a member of the cabinet.
Okay, could you share with us some of the personal experiences with Mwalim?
Well, let me say this again. Mwalim, the person whom I worked with, is a very liberal-minded person who listens to whatever points of view may be forthcoming, from whether his ministers, his senior civil servants, or from members of the party. And he's not somebody who is self-centered, that once I've decided, that's it. He's ready to correct himself when I think we made a mistake. He promoted democratic practices even when the country was under one party
system.
And I gave this example of how we took tax measures to parliament under one party system. They were rejected. And they gave them a second opportunity, and they reconsidered it and they approved it. And this goes on and on and on. Sisiom Tombaini, hard headed, I think he's a very human person, very religious person.
God fearing.
I think so. I think we were fortunate to have such a person as our first president.
Father of the nation.
Who even the Arusha Declaration, when you look into it thoroughly, was trying to figure out the core values which Tanzanian society as a nation we should try and strive for, irrespective of our colors, our political views and whatever and whatever. So that the Nyerere I knew.
You were the chairman of Kilimanjaro Development Forum for 15 years until you stepped down in 2019. Could you share with us what the objectives of this forum are, the accomplishment attained during your tenure, and your wishes and aspiration for it?
Yeah. KDF, maybe you needed to know a little bit of the story behind it. After Nyerere had stepped down, there was established an organization called the Nyerere Foundation, Mwalimu Nyerere Foundation, which sets out to see whether they can promote some of the ideas that Nyerere preached and tried to implement during his career. So the foundation, after he stepped down, they went around all the regions and they held a debate and discussion with the leadership of one panel. how are you going to translate some of Mwalimu's ideas of development without waiting for someone to bring development? How can you advise and mobilize the population to look at their own situation? If there are problems, see what they can do to reverse the situation, that kind of thing. Now, in this debate which they had in Kilimanjaro, two things happened. They saw that the economy of Kilimanjaro was going downhill because it was essentially dependent on coffee and the coffee production had been going down. Reasons, several, population is increasing, land availability is scarce. So it was thought that they should set up a forum for people who would like to continue this debate to see how we can reverse the development trend instead of going down to make it move upward. So that's when they started this idea of a development forum, and I was elected as chairman, and we had a group of about 40 or 50 people, members of parliaments, regional commissioners, other leaders, church leaders, religious leaders, all sorts. And the question was to look at Kilimanjaro and say, in addition to what is being done by the government and what additionality
can
be done by the people themselves or by attracting other people to come in. Now, for example, in Kilimanjaro, one of the ideas was, I think at one time, they had promoted this idea of renting out the Kilimanjaro International Airport to a European company, hoping that it was going to generate more traffic and encourage people to export their vegetables and what have you from Arusha Moshi through Kia instead of sending them all the way to Nairobi. Big argument about revival of some industries which were established by the government and which since have been closed, whether they could be revived. So the idea was how to revive it, create more employment, and generally regenerate the economy. Lot of ideas, lot of studies, but very little action. So we eventually decided to hand over to new generation, and we now have got a new team which is supposed to take us from there and move on.
So since your retirement from active Tanzania government roles and ultimately your parliamentary position, what have you mostly occupied your time with?
Well, in a way, first, of course, I'm retired. That takes priority number one. But I've also been busy with other things. For example, until recently, I was chairman of Tanzania Breweries.
Yes.
Until recently, was it a month or so? I was a chancellor of the Ardi University. Back at home, we have our concerns with the local development in my home district, Mwanga. In our church, the Lutheran Church, where we have been awarded status of a diocese and that kind of thing. And generally advise on anything that I think can be of use to the community, apart from running my own family. My also problems come to me, you know, this and that, you know.
As one of the country's senior leader who has successfully served in various and highest positions in Tanzania government, and also your political party, starting from TANU to CCM, and seen it all from Mwalimu to President Samia, What do you think are the most important attributes that a young leader today needs to attain so they can best be equipped for success?
When I look at the question, I wasn't quite sure whether you were asking specifically if I was running a company, you might ask me that question. Because then I can enthuse younger people how to fight for themselves and be self-employed and become big businessmen. For politics and leadership, it's a different thing. First, I believe whoever wants to try that route has got to do a lot of soul searching and believe that he really has a call to serve the people and run away from the current temptation that people think going into politics means getting better jobs and the best. Secondly, you must be humble enough to listen to whatever ideas that will come from those people you want to serve. And avoid the temptation of being a dictator of some fixed ideas that you think you can change the people tonight. You must be prepared to change if you think you've made a mistake or things are not working the way you thought they should be. I believe Tanzanians, as we are at the moment, the biggest challenge is with this population of over 60 million people, over 50% of whom are young people, with the basic education which we have never had before. The other day I was looking at the number of secondary schools we have, including Izakata. There are nearly 4,000 or 5,000 schools. At the university level, they say there are about, is it 147 or
47?
47. And you go into these places, Bunge, ministries, full of highly trained people. Now the question is, if a country is fortunate enough to have this human capital, and assuming those with the human capital, they are ready to utilize it to solve some of the challenges that they face us, we should be better off than what we were during our time. For the younger generation, they must plan to work harder, to look to themselves as the ultimate solution to their challenges, rather than hope that a thing called the government or Mama Samia or somebody is going to solve all these problems. Well, they don't work that way. One thing very attracted me, when I was in parliament, we had a colleague who was an Indian. She came from Morogoro, Shamim Khan. Her husband was a teacher. They had a son who went to national service just north of Dodoma. And she said, you know, we're making preparation for this young man to look after himself when he finishes his national service and his education. So I asked her, what are you doing? She said, very simple. We have hired a shop. We have given him a small capital. And he has got to struggle with that capital, running that little shop on his own, all the time coming to consult us, me and my husband, to see whether he is on the right track as a small retailer, shopkeeper. So the Indians do kawalas. They have designed a system where they educate the young people. But ask anybody. The mistake we're making is that we educate our young people. But unlike the Indians who have this system of apprenticeship to try and learn,
they groom the children from early on.
Ours, we train them and then we say, oh, I'll telephone madam, maybe she'll fix you there. And they move around with the hordes and hordes of copies of CVs and whatever. Move from one place to another and they get nothing. So whenever they come to me, I say, forget about that. Can you look into something which you can do? And use your head. I gave them an example of my good parent, my good daughter. She studied in Arusha, in an accountancy school there. She qualified with a CPA or whatever it is. And then she began looking for a job. Try this, try that, try that. Of course, the jobs are not there. So one day they came to me with their parents and said, what? I said, forget about those jobs. If they do appear, apply. If you are lucky, you'll get it. But can she crack
come
her head and
yeah.
come up with something she can do herself? And they went away. Eventually they invited me. Apparently she had struggled. She had established Amaduka ya Vipodozi. Established a shop. And also, you know, the
pedicure, manicure.
And through that process, she managed to get a future husband who is an army chap. He paid the dowry to the parents. So they invited me to the marriage ceremony. And there was, apparently they told this young man who was going to marry my
granddaughter.
That I should be given a blanket. So that because I'm going to lose a wife with any better
comment. Yeah.
That the blanket is. But she's now happy. She's earning money. The husband is happy with his army career. This is an accountant. She's put the. And she's still looking for possibility of others. And I'm sure, just as we are doing this kind of thing, if people are exercising their minds, this country would change. But it needs to be emphasized. The other thing is, I was talking to some friends who came to see me the other day. Government, through local authorities, they're pouring money to women, youth, and those people with the inabilities. But there's also another fund which the government, I think, is borrowing money from World Bank, called the TASAF.
Yeah.
Now, TASAF, we've got two components. One is to finance community projects like roads and schools and whatever. But the other one is to dish out cash to poor families, whether they can use it to buy things, to eat, education, whatever. And they hope through that way you reduce poverty. Someone was saying if there was to be an auditor today and went throughout this country in all these local authorities and document the money that had been dished year in, year out, and what it has achieved, I don't think there would be much to see, including this TASAF.
Yeah.
Where they go and dish in cash to so-called
poor families.
I don't know. But that's up to you people to do research and see whether this is a resource worthwhile to spend.
It's really working, yeah? Okay. Thank you so much, Mheshimiwa, for setting aside some time to be a guest on this show and for sharing your knowledge and wealth of experience.
Well, I hope it will help. If it does, I will be very grateful to have performed that little public duty. If it doesn't match with your requirements, just throw it away and forget about it.
No, I'll come back again.
Asante sana.
The Sabrina Oncast podcast special edition with Cleopa David Msuya is produced in collaboration with Watu People. Abdul Kide is the co-producer, and the music you heard is from Pixabay, Podcast CO, and many more. Please stay tuned for more interesting episodes ahead.